Sociology Symposium. I'll do that one more time. So welcome everybody to the Media Sociology Symposium. I would like to introduce our morning keynote speaker, Dr. Grant Plank. Grant Plank is a departmental lecturer at the Oxford Internet Institute. He began his career as an independent consultant based in Chicago, specializing in research design, statistical analysis, and database design. He previously taught at American University in Washington, D.C. He completed his PhD in sociology at the University of Chicago in 1999 and joined the Oxford Internet Institute in 2010. He was a survey research fellow until August of 2020. He received the William F. Ogburn Career Achievement Award from the SITAM section of ASA in 2015. This award recognizes a sustained body of research that has made an outstanding contribution to the advancement of knowledge in the area of sociology of communication, information technology, and media sociology. He was awarded a Teaching Excellence Award from the University of Oxford in 2015. He has been awarded a visiting fellowship to the Center for the Advanced Internet Studies at Ruhr University in Bochum, Germany for 2 months, working on a cross-national study of echo chambers in 6 European countries and the United States. The study is unusual in that it looks at possible echo chambers in the context of the entire media environment, including online media, social media, and offline broadcasting and print media. The question is, in this kind of high-choice media environment, do people limit their political media consumption in such a way that they could find themselves in an echo chamber? He is a sociologist who studies the social and cultural impact of the internet and new media. He is also interested in cultural sociology, especially reviews and cultural evaluation. Let's give a warm welcome to Grant.
Okay, Ken, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I'm going to start here by attempting to share my screen. Let's go from there. Ah, there we go. Okay. Great. Thanks, Ken. I'm going to talk about a set of things that we're not studying in the right way. This is a very personal view. It'll be very idiosyncratic. And so I look forward to your comments on this. Certainly anyone who feels like I've misrepresented something I would love to hear that. So as I said, I really do look forward to comments. So with that as a sort of brief introduction, let me talk more explicitly about, if I can get, why am I not able to switch to a new, there we go. Okay. The idea for this talk came from my unease with the kind of research I was reading. Too much of it was focused on collecting easy data, often from social media. There were too many good papers that were driven by the ability to collect easy data and not necessarily because this was an important problem. So I thought there was too little focus on important problems, meaning important for social theory, for society, or for policy. Too much work had been focused on the low-hanging fruit of data and not on hard issues. And one example that criticized this was this Aral and Nicolaides paper that's referenced there on the screen. This paper basically asked the question, do friends influence each other's running? And the answer is yes. Now, in many ways, this is a great paper, and I'm sort of picking on it because it is such a good paper. It's methodologically strong, it has an elegant design, it has high quality data, and it's a superb computational effort. But it's extremely weak theory. It's hard to know how to apply it in environments other than running. It's hard to know how you would apply the results from a study of exercise to an important problem. So, you know, it's a great paper, but so what is the problem? So the subtitle of this talk is A Personal View, and it will not be comprehensive. It will be idiosyncratic, and I want to stress that. So a little bit about myself will give you some context for the ideas that follow. I'm mostly interested in structure, and in this sense, I'm a fan of people like Max Weber and Georg Simmel. In fact, I published a paper on Weber and the internet. I think of myself as a classic sociologist in that I study inequality, specifically inequality on the internet. Inequality is a big tent, of course, as all of us who are sociologists know, and it covers everything from forms of internet use to how online skills are acquired to the politics of echo chambers. My background is in the sociology of culture, and so I'm interested in meaning. I'm an empirical sociologist. I publish both qualitative and quantitative papers, but always empirically based. So I'm going to be talking mostly about empirical work today. The original idea for this paper came to me several years ago. This was part during one of several controversies over Instagram pictures harming the body image of teenage girls. Now at the OII, we have several faculty who study internet policy and technology regulation. Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, Sandra Wachter, Brent Mittelstadt, for example. And we always have a lot of students who are interested in internet policy. So I proposed to a set of master's students the following thesis topic. Write the text of a law that prohibits Instagram and TikTok pictures from harming teenage girls, but does not also simultaneously ban all fashion magazines. So at the OII, we see new phenomenon. I'm missing a slide here, and I don't quite understand why. I'm going to just talk about the slide then. So we're interested in online phenomenon, and we're particularly interested in things that are new or changed as a result of the internet. So we ask, what is this new? So the slide that you should have seen was a graph from Michael Rosenberg's research at Stanford on how couples meet. And what's very clear is the dramatic impact of the internet. The internet, of course, had no impact whatsoever until about the middle 90s. Most people met through friends. They would meet through work. They would meet through church. They would meet through avocations, hobbies. They would meet in college and so on. But after about 25 years ago, the internet basically went from zero to almost the most important single medium through which couples meet. And for same-sex couples, it's absolutely the most important medium. So we see a dramatic change due to the internet. And that's the kind of thing that we're looking for. We want a real discontinuity as a result of the internet. But whether social phenomena have changed is a real question. The internet has not changed everything, and I'm going to give you four examples. First example here is that the numbers of close friends, distant friends, and acquaintances do not appear to have changed at all. The internet has had no impact on the number of different kinds of relationships. The structure of friendships has not changed. And it also seems to be true that intimate friends are people you see face to face. All this makes sense if you followed Robin Dunbar's theory that relationships of all kinds are related to biological cognitive capacity. Now, in most research, the null hypothesis for most things is simply whatever is happening offline, the same thing is going to be duplicated online. So in addition to friendships, we see this in many sociological research areas. For example, status distinctions tend to be maintained online. High status people retain their status, low status people do not enhance their status, and changes are unusual. This, of course, mirrors a lot of offline research. Third, high status people tend to benefit more than low status people from the internet. High status people tend to use the internet in ways that enhance their status. Low status people tend to use the internet in ways that are not status enhancing. When I talk about this, I am reminded of Bourdieu's theory of habitus. People act according to their habitus, and their habitus does not change because they are in front of a screen. And fourth, the internet, above all else, is a communications media, but that doesn't mean that everyone is easier to reach online. In fact, people who are hard to reach online, offline, are also hard to reach online. There are implications of this for public policy. In emergencies, the people who you can't reach through standard mass media will not be reached by sending out a tweet or an instant message or posting on Facebook. Another policy example is people who receive government assistance, like income support or unemployment, are disproportionately hard to reach by offline means, like postal letters. They're even harder to reach online because they're disproportionately not online. So I could add a number of other examples, but the point of these examples is that the internet is not always, and possibly not generally, a source of change. So we're looking at changes, and has the internet changed anything? So I'm going to talk about 10 topics today where we're not paying nearly enough attention, I think, or perhaps we're paying the wrong attention. So you can see them here on the screen. I'll talk about ethics and commodification of AI, the impact of AI on social theory, disintermediation and stratification, scholarly conferences, that'll be a bit meta, cryptocurrency, war, venture capital, self-driving cars, social media, and mobile phone use. So let me just start here with ethics and commoditization of AI. Artificial intelligence is notoriously hard to define, so I'm basically going to be talking about machine learning and neural networks. The key here is, of course, machine learning made it possible for computers to identify and analyze images, starting about 15 years ago. Now, at the OII, we have a number of people who study AI and ethics, people like Luciano Floridi, for example. And there is value in studying much of the classic machine learning systems like facial recognition or support systems for prison and parole and so on. These are systems, the characteristic of these systems is that the AI is open and it's a central component of the system. But these sort of systems are an increasingly small part of AI. Once you get beyond the frontier of AI, and by frontier, I mean things like GPT-3 or DALL-E or Imagen, AI is being incorporated into software of all kinds. It's just part of the software and it doesn't have any special status. Products like decision support systems or management information systems are now beginning to contain AI in them. AI has become commoditized. It's built into open source Python libraries and ordinary developers can easily include it in their products. In this sense, AI will become part of everything and it will become invisible. Companies don't build and sell machine learning, it's just software. This brings us to the ethics problem. The embedded nature of commodity AI means you can't easily know that it's there. So you can't do an ethical audit in any meaningful way, let alone access the code or the output. And this changes the nature of AI ethics in ways that current work has not recognized. If you're studying something like facial recognition, then it's clear this is AI. And there are really known metrics that you can use to describe things like the fairness of the facial recognition. You can apply ethical principles like privacy and security, and things like that. But how do you even know that a company has added an algorithm derived from machine learning to your university's finance software? How would you audit the AI in the university's student information system? How would you even know that it existed? So AI ethics has not really faced the fact that AI is everywhere and it's deeply embedded. This is a whole problem that's completely neglected by current research. Second, I want to talk about the impact on social theory. There are tremendous resources that have been going into machine learning and other AI tools. You know, and in the business world, this is having a significant impact. If you've read the AI job listings in the past couple of years, you've noticed that every university wants to hire social data scientists. And there are millions of dollars going into AI tools in the US, in US universities. In the UK, a consortium of universities formed the Alan Turing Institute and got millions of pounds of funding from the British government. These sorts of AI projects think about things like regulation, online harms, robotics, and healthcare. These are important topics that should be very clear, but they're not promising avenues to develop new and innovative ways to think about social life. Despite all of these resources that have gone into AI, it's had little impact on sociology or social theory. In the first place, it's very hard to find available data that address important problems. And from the point of view of a sociologist, we have a methodology that is in search of a problem. Now, in the past, we have seen new methodologies that have broken out into wide use because they've been used in a stellar example of research. And I'm going to mention just one of them. This is James Coleman's famous equality of educational opportunity research. This particular project was one of the first large comprehensive studies of the factors that contributed to student learning. And it introduced multiple regression. And the approach in this project convinced many sociologists that multiple regression was a valuable, important tool that they needed to learn. It's an example of an important problem being addressed by what was at that time a very new tool. We have no such example of AI. We need an example of research where everything's done right. High quality data, high quality design, high quality theory, all of these combined to address an important problem, and the result of which is a serious advance in our understanding of this topic. We don't have any such examples. As a result, AI methods have had little impact on sociological theory. This brings me to disintermediation and stratification. Now, many stratification systems are based on scarce resources like space or barriers to entry like high capital costs. Now, the key characteristic of the internet is that it reduces the cost of communication and therefore the cost of coordination. So one of the most visible effects of the internet is to disintermediate major industries. Disintermediate, of course, means removal of intermediaries. And in sociological terms, this means removal of intermediate levels of hierarchy. A large part of sociology is based on the study of hierarchies and stratification. So to paraphrase William Julius Rilson, who wrote a book called When Work Disappears, what happens when hierarchy disappears? What happens, where do the elites go? Where do the proletarians of the hierarchy go? The sort of flattening of hierarchies has a number of effects. Both elites and proles become very different and the power relationships change. We can see this if we look at disintermediation in music. I'm going to use this as an example because it was possibly the earliest large industry to be disintermediated by the internet. Changes were driven by two factors. One is the rapid price reductions in music, and the fact that music could be easily converted to bits and streamed over the internet. This removed a lot of the friction from consuming music. So if we look at the music industry, we see major changes. First is the first new entrant to the industry was Napster, but it didn't have a sustainable business model. And later sustainable models came from Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. And these made it possible for consumers to connect to music without intermediaries like record stores or music labels. So one of the first things we saw was for consumers, the most notable first effect was a rapid, steep decline in the price of music. Second, there was a very rapid increase in the amount of music available. Now, more subtly, not only were record stores removed as intermediaries, but other intermediaries were challenged. By about 2010, it was possible for musicians to make a decent living without a contract with a music label. Self-published music made up an increasing share of increasing share of the commercially successful music. So this was a really important change in the relative power of musicians and music labels. Fourth, quality became less predictable, partly because of the rise of self-published music, meant that the gatekeeping role of music labels was weakened. And finally, a number of new entrants, like Spotify and Apple, replaced many of the old music labels. So we saw a rapid shrinkage in the old music labels. So disintermediation has been widely studied in economics and finance, but it's too important to leave to economists and business schools. This is an example where major parts of a stratification system were destroyed and then rebuilt again because of the internet. So this raises a whole set of interesting questions. For example, questions, in fact, that economists and business schools will never touch. One is, how were changes in the gatekeeping system? How were the record labels replaced? What are the new gatekeepers in the system? Second, if music is much easier to be consumed, then this has implications for domestication theory. And in fact, the re-domestication of an existing product like music could possibly lead to some theoretical extensions in the spirit of Michael Burroway's extended case model. Third, we have changes in the cost and availability of the music will change how music is consumed, which has implications for elaboration likelihood theory. As music consumption changes, there are clear links to uses and gratifications theory. And finally, the way music is consumed has links to media dependency theory. So the point is, there's a lot of sociological material here that is not being utilized. Now, this brings us to painting. What happened to painting? You know, despite the fact that artists could reach buyers directly through the internet starting in the 1990s, and despite the fact that many people dislike galleries, the artist gallery system has remained largely intact for the last 25 years of the internet. Online art sales exist, but they have not disintermediated galleries. So what's going on? What are the characteristics of the art market that make it resistant to disintermediation when music and books and a variety of other products were not able to resist disintermediation? There's very little research on this. In fact, we don't have good comparative studies of disintermediation. We need a theory of disintermediation, which we don't have. You can see I have some pointers to that in chapter 8 of my book on reviews. Now I'm going to be a little bit meta because I'm going to talk about scholarly conferences at a conference. Now we've all gone to conferences before. And we all know about conferences. So what happens at a scholarly conference? Well, we're away from home, away from our work environment and all the usual events that go on in our work environment, like the distractions of students, administrative demands, and so on. Second, there are people on a platform who read papers or conduct a panel. Third, there are book exhibits. Fourth, there are plenary sessions that talk about the theme of the conference. Fifth, there are employers and job seekers meeting each other. Sixth, we schedule meetings, lunches, dinners, and coffee with friends from graduate school who we see only once a year. And finally, there are receptions and parties. The point is that like all successful social institutions, conferences are a package of characteristics. We've just had 2 years of experience, compulsory experience, attempting to duplicate that package in online video. So after 2 years, where are we? Now, for some parts of the package, online tools work fairly well, notably the paper sessions, the panels, and the plenaries. In fact, I've given paper presentations to conferences in Asia where I could not justify the 2 days of travel time. I need a reason to travel for days instead of spending an hour on Zoom. One of the advantages of the conversion to online conferences is that now, at one time, being a face on the screen would have been awkward. Now being a face on the screen sounds like normal. But most of the rest of the package works badly. No one has developed software that duplicates bumping into someone in the book exhibits and having a great conversation. Now, this is really important. There are ASA conversations where I never went to a single session because I met too many interesting people in the halls and the book exhibits. Adding a text chat to a video stream is not the same as a party or a reception. Neither is creating virtual rooms like Speakeasy or Gather. In fact, I will note one of the problems here is illustrated by the fact that I went to one birthday party on Speakeasy, and along with the invite came a six-page PDF of single-spaced instructions on how to use Speakeasy at this party. Yeah, that's the way to put everyone into the mood to party. So this problem is general. No one has successfully converted a networking event into a virtual interaction, into a virtual event. The interaction problem has not been solved. Now, this is a professional embarrassment, I think, because sociologists are supposed to know about interaction and social life. The theories that companies have used to try to build models of venues have universally failed. And this is kind of a failure of the profession. We need a much better understanding of how and why online and offline interactions are different and the ways that they're different and how these differences could be bridged. I think the key to better theory here is the point that I mentioned near the beginning of the previous slide, which is at a conference, I'm away from my usual environment. A central part of a scholarly conference package is the experience exists in a kind of limbo outside of normal academic life. And part of its appeal is that the difference in the environment, which is stimulating and refreshing. If I sit in my office and stare at a screen, that's my normal life. And this suggests severe limits to online video. So the problem is that there's no way to get those spontaneous conversations in the book exhibit. Okay, let me switch to crypto. The appeal of cryptocurrency is this is money not controlled by government. For some people, this is an ideological appeal. It's part of Bitcoin ideology, mostly libertarian, and it goes back to the ideas of Friedrich von Hayek. For others, the appeal is practical, that it's much easier to hide fraud and other illegal activity if the money is never reported to any law enforcement agency. Over the past 15 years, large numbers of cryptocurrencies have each built a sort of a capital market. And some currencies have been astonishingly successful. Just to give you one really good example, the first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, was worth 10 cents a coin in 2010. 12 years later, it has traded as high as $65,000 a coin, although it's since fallen considerably. Since cryptocurrencies have no intrinsic value and no institutional support, there are only two reasons to hold them. First is that other people will accept them in payment, so they can act as a store of value. And second is they might appreciate in value. Now, this second speculative reason has been extremely important for cryptocurrencies. A lot of people bought crypto because they thought other people would buy crypto and therefore its value would go up. This is a fascinating example of the form of thinking that is the basis for many of the things that sociologists call collective behavior. Now, recently, cryptocurrency has been having a type of capital market crash, complete with frozen withdrawals, versions of bank runs, and serial collapses as the failure of one cryptocurrency firm triggered other failures. Even some of the so-called stable coins, supposedly backed 100% by reserves, have crashed. An economist would just say, that's a market crash, and would say, you know, preventing such a disastrous loss of value is exactly why governments regulate their currency. But this kind of collective behavior is something that sociologists have studied for decades, and there's sociological questions here as well. Is this really just a latter-day version of the 1600s Dutch tulip mania? No, the Economist Buttonwood columnist argued this week, for example, that every extreme of greed and fear has a precedent. Technology changes, but people do not, unquote. Is that all? Is that true? Is that all there is? Sociology has a number of theories of collective behavior. Are they explanatory? We have capital markets that have been created. We have market crashes. How and why is this different from other markets? Is this one of the cases where the internet has changed things? And if so, what? So I'm going to talk about war for a little bit here. We're now just 5 months into a major war in Europe. So you could reasonably ask, why am I talking about Monday media sociology this morning when my news is filled with pictures of destroyed buildings and reports of people dying, being killed? Now, I'm not a military sociologist and I'm not a geopolitical theorist, but it's important to ask, what does war say about communication and media? So a great deal can be said, I think, about war and communication, and I'm going to focus fairly narrowly on some blockchain issues. The war changes some things that have already been researched. For example, social media and smartphones have used before in war, although the volume and impact of open source media is unprecedented. Russia has been vigorously censoring its media, including the internet. It's interesting, the US government is supporting a major effort to get VPNs into the hands of Russian people so they can evade censorship. It's an ironic thing that the American government is supporting libertarian ideals here. So there is a censorship issue that also links to internet technology. And these are some new issues that have been created by the Russian invasion. Web3 is supposed to be the next version of the internet based on decentralization and built on blockchain technology. Now, Russia has banned several social media platforms. Suppose a Web3 platform was based on decentralized blockchain. Could Russia block it without also blocking it worldwide? Enthusiasts have said that Web3 is the internet of the future. And blockchain is supposed to not require trusted third parties to authenticate users. This leads to the claim that blockchains are uncensorable. These enthusiastic claims, of course, immediately suggest links to sociological studies of millenarian communities, or if you're cynical, a link to Festinger's book titled When Prophecy Fails. In practice, blockchain has looked quite different. For example, OpenSea, which is the main NFT marketplace, has had so many scams and frauds, it's adding a verification system. And the irony here is that requiring a trusted third party is exactly what blockchain is supposed to eliminate. So there's a war link here. If a social media platform was built on the uncensorable Web3, could it block Russian posts or refuse to accept Russian ads? This is a question of platform design, how much flexibility Web3 allows, and it suggests links to the sociology of technology design and some of the sociology of science issues. There's also a cryptocurrency here. Remember, part of the appeal of blockchain-based currency is that it's not controlled by a government. So there is now a direct conflict with the move to sanction a rogue country and expel it from international capital and product markets. If you can't use, so suddenly the idea of a Web3 monetary system where no one is in control is not abstract anymore, and it's become political. Features of the Web3 system will be generated in part by political and social processes, including government regulation. And this moves the whole Web3 into the remit of communication and of sociology. And it suggests other links to the sociology of science and the sociology of technology design. Skipping right along here, I'm going to talk about venture capital. This was developed in the 1960s as an entirely new form of capital, like the development of the joint stock company. And it's designed for companies who are considered too risky for bank loans. Almost all tech companies receive venture capital in the beginning. It's very distinctive, and it combined unconventional experimental ideas with hard commercial targets that free talents to convert ideas into products. You can contrast it to banks or bond markets, where because venture capital is a very hands-on form of finance where venture capitalists become often personally involved with the companies they fund. The result here has been a productive form of applied science, and it's a new form of capital supporting applied science. Now, Schumpeter distinguishes between invention and innovation. And innovation is what puts science into practice. That's what venture capital does. It's so successful that a whole ecosystem of institutions has developed to help potential entrepreneurs develop business plans and connect to venture capital funds. I'm thinking here of the Y Combinator incubators to provide training and mentorship. There's a lot of work on this in finance and economics, but this is another one of these topics that's too important to be left to the economists as business schools. There are clearly links here to social studies of science and science and technology studies. Venture capital is a key element in a very large, very influential new socio-technical system. What is the relationship between applied science in this system and other forms of science? How do they influence each other? What extent does the type of financing influence the form of the product? Venture capital is heavily dependent on networks. Social capital is important, and this links to network studies. Many people have expressed concern about the negative effects of the new communications technologies. There's a whole group of people studying bias in algorithms or the negative effects of social media on politics. But how can you really understand those sorts of things if you don't understand the structural incentives and the goals of the tech companies? You need to understand the tech companies' economic base and their economic incentives, and that means understanding venture capital. So venture capital is the key to understanding the technical ecosystem of Silicon Valley, and we need much more research into it. Speaking of innovation, I will turn to self-driving cars. We've seen enormous hype around self-driving cars. Elon Musk has predicted full self-driving cars would be available for sale, quote, next year, every year since 2017. Uber has said it would have 100,000 self-driving taxis on the road by 2020. None of this happened. So where are we with self-driving cars? Well, there was very rapid early progress using machine learning and lots of sensors. And Tesla has continued down the same path. It's been throwing more processing power, more sensors, and more machine learning at the problem. But in recent years, progress has stopped working. They've hit a wall, and throwing more sensors, more databases, and faster processors hasn't worked. Regardless of what Elon Musk says, when Tesla tells legal regulators what their cars can do, it says they are level 2 out of 5 levels, where level 5 is full self-driving capability. Level 2 means basically the car will stay in its own lane and it will slow down when the car in front of it brakes. This is a long way from a car with no steering wheel. A car without a steering wheel will probably not appear in our lifetime. So this is reminiscent of Hiram Maxim. Now, many of you know about the word Maxim. You know his last name because he invented the Maxim gun, which was the first lightweight machine gun. He was a serial inventor, and he was an early power in steam-powered fright. Steam, okay? He says in his autobiography that he had solved all of the problems of flight in the 1880s, 20 years before the Wright brothers, but he couldn't develop a lightweight steam engine to power his airplanes. The solution here had to wait for the development of an entirely new technology. And the Wright brothers built their engine as an internal combustion engine. One of the heroes of the Wright brothers' flight is the mechanic who built the Wright brothers' engine. The research issue here is, what's happening? Do we have other, an entire product could not develop for years or decades because a crucial technology was not available? This is not a situation like, for example, the modern bicycle, where all of the technology was available for decades before it was assembled into the technological form of the modern safety bicycle in the 1890s. For cars, for self-driving cars, the needed technology simply doesn't exist. This is a clear opportunity for science and technology studies, because we've seen a number of studies that look backward, and they have seen how these sort of problems have been solved. I mean, looking, for example, at the problem of flight, but we can look backward 100 years later and we can see, oh, we see what the solution is. Right now, we're in a different situation. We don't know what the solution is. We have a socio-technical system that's hit a technological wall. And what can current theory say about this? I'm not aware of any easy way sort of theory that applies very well. There's also an issue of the hype cycle here in technology. And self-driving cars are an extremely interesting example where a technology has failed to develop as expected. What does that say about the study of technology? Just to give you an example of the problems of self-driving cars, I have a slide here that describes High Bridge Street in Oxford. The characteristics of Oxford are, it has very narrow streets where in some cases two cars can't pass each other if there's a parked car. There are often no white lines. And you notice here, this is High Bridge Street. There's no center line here. There's often no edge striping. Here they're the double yellow lines, meaning no parking, no stopping. And cars are competing with bicycles and lots of other devices. Now you can see here, if you see my cursor, there's a bicycle. And this car here, this dark car, has moved out to give the bicycle sufficient clearance. There's a legal minimum clearance. But there's an oncoming car here. You see a white car. And if you notice the width of the street here to the right of this car, this dark car, it's going to have to move over to the left to give room for the white car to pass it. So in effect, what you're going to have is a bicycle and two cars passing each other, and none of them will be able to achieve the legal minimum distance that they're supposed to give to the other cars. These are the sort of problems that cars have in Oxford, and a self-driving car to drive in this environment is not going to exist in our lifetime. This brings me to social media. Social media is a complicated subject. There's an enormous amount of research on this. Haight and Bale have a Google Docs document with a literature review titled Social Media and Political Dysfunction. It's a 165-page long lit review of issues of political disruption. And if you look at this, your best conclusion here is most of what we think we know about social media is wrong. We do not actually know much about social media. In the past decade, social media has expanded and fragmented far beyond Facebook and Twitter. And the issue is social media are a new social form. And if that's true, and that is a question, we need to describe what's distinctive about this social form. So I see the core question is, what is distinctive about social media? It's easy to find arguments that social media themselves are distinctive, but it's hard to find a description of the distinctive characteristics that apply to social media. We don't have a good theory of social media, and there's very little work on social media right now. It's not clear, it's actually not clear that we need a complete theory of social media, but given all the bad negative effects that have been attributed to social media, we can reasonably ask what's new here and what's going on. This brings me to mobile phones. Now, Apple introduced the smartphone in 2007. 15 years ago. And since then, the effect of this has been amazing. There are now more smartphones than there are adults in the world. And in fact, according to Ofcom, the British telecommunications regulator, in 2020, 21% of UK people accessed the internet only through their mobile phone. So mobile phones began as an appendage to a laptop PC, but PCs are now an appendage to mobile phones. They are the biggest commercial product, consumer product of our lifetimes. We will never again see a product that will be adopted by billions of people in the space of 15 years. So the key characteristic of a smartphone is that every smartphone is different. Smartphones are completely customizable using apps. The result is that your smartphone may be completely different from mine. And that says that mobile phones are an extraordinarily flexible, malleable device. They are less bound to any particular set of affordances than other products. And this has serious research implications. One implication is that mobile phone research done before the widespread use of smartphones is probably outdated. Smartphones are used quite differently from mobile phones. A second research implication is that researchers can't simply treat smartphone as a phone. They must learn how the respondent uses their phone in order to understand its implications. And there's a serious lack of appreciation for this among people who study mobile phones. Many still treat smartphones as a unitary category, but that's not correct anymore. A survey cannot just ask a single question about whether a respondent has a smartphone. They have to ask a series of questions about how the respondents use their phone. And we don't have a theory of mobile phone use. We need a set of categories of use that can be empirically distinguished. So you can see Ralph Schroeder has done a bit of work on this, that he talks about something he calls the time and attention economy. That's worth your time to look at. So this brings me to the OII itself. At the OII, we occasionally think about changing our name because Oxford Internet Institute is kind of awkward and it sounds like a research institute and not a scholarly department of the University of Oxford. So nobody really likes it. But being faculty members, you will understand that our problem is we can never agree on a new name. There are too many suggestions for alternatives to settle on a new name. I propose that if we want to remain on the leading edge of the internet, we should change our name to the Oxford Mobile Phone Institute. So with that thought, I want to thank you and I look forward to your questions.